chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh, and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat with Nick.
Hello, everyone. We've got Ed Delia with us today. Ed, whereabouts in the world are you?
We're based in White House, New Jersey, USA.
Okay, so we haven't had a New Jersey person on the podcast yet, so I'm quite excited about that. They've all been California-based.
On the other coast.
Yeah, so it's so good to get a representative sample of the quality of branding people around the states. So, Ed, thanks so much for joining us, and quite an interesting history. I mean, you've got a BA in English, and you're also a PCM. I think in Europe and other countries, it's called a chartered marketer, but this is a certified marketer, which is quite a good title. And you've been in the family business for, what is that now, 25 years?
According to LinkedIn, I think I'm coming up on 28.
Awesome. So why don't you give us a bit of background about Delia and Associates, and let us know what your business does and where you are at today.
Great. Sure. Well, thanks so much for having me on, Nick. It's great to be with you today. So Delia Associates was founded in 1964 by my father, Michael Delia, in classic entrepreneurial style. He had a little tiny office adjacent to his bedroom. And that's where Delia Associates began. And because he had done a brief career, he was a naval officer, and he hurt himself and was honorably discharged. So his naval days were over. And he had a brief career working for a brand called Avon Products, the beauty brand, in their package development group. So in that group, he was learning a lot about plastics at the time. In the 60s, plastics were becoming more mainstream for consumer goods and how plastics were processed. So lo and behold, some of his early clients were in the plastics and packaging industries. And we still service those industries to this day. So he founded Delia Associates as a traditional B2B advertising and PR firm. And I came along, so I'm the youngest of three. And I grew up around the business, as many kids will do when there's a family business in play. Not really thinking much of it. I mean, I was collating press kits when I was 7. I think I was helping my brothers build trade show booths when I was 13. I wrote my first published press release when I was 15 or 16, and I was doing media analysis at 17. Not really thinking anything of it. It's just what you did, you know, when you're around a family business. And had no intentions of joining, let alone leading or buying this company. In fact, I was I'm on record as saying when I was about to graduate college, I was in line ready to get my diploma, and my good friend was next to me. And I said to him, I don't know what I'm going to do next exactly, but I'll be damned if I go to work for my old man. And, you know, so if I ever make an affirmative statement, Nick, you bet the ranch on the opposite. So a few months later, I'm turning down a job opportunity to go to work at Delia Associates full time. And that was August of 95. So they say that time flies when you're having fun. And my goodness, I felt like I looked up and a year had passed. Yeah. And it's like, it was just so rapid, so fast that that kind of told me I'm in the right place. And I think that's a good, something that I'll often tell young people that are about to start their careers. Hey, if you're watching the clock every minute of the day and can't wait to get out of there, you're probably in the wrong place. But if you look up and you say, oh my goodness, it's 5:30 and I'm still here and I didn't even realize it, or it's 6 o'clock or 8 o'clock, you're probably in a good place. That means you're engaged, you're engrossed, and you're loving what you're doing. So that's kind of how it was for me out of the gate.
There's a couple of parallels between your story and mine, actually. Well, your dad's story and mine. I've actually done work for Avon as well in across Africa. And I started out in packaging and design as well. So I know exactly what you mean about building booths. And I can tell you hexachromes. I can tell you what papers used, what stock. But that industry is gone. Not gone, but it has changed fundamentally, you know, from, you know, 1995, or, well, definitely the 60s to now. And I think that segue from focusing on sort of consumer goods and packaging and traditional advertising has obviously moved over to digital. So, and I believe your business has also made that migration as well. I mean, there's still packaging to be done out there, but I think a lot of it's done in Turkey, China, and other places, and much less of it in the States.
Well, it depends on certain specialized or specialty packaging, you know, is still largely stateside. But yeah, things that are what might be construed as more commoditized packaging formats are often sourced from outside this country. That's for sure.
So our discussion today is really going to be on the focus of your business now, which is B2B. And B2B is the ugly duckling in the marketing world, because everyone wants to do consumer, beautiful packaging, beautiful design, TV adverts directly to consumers. I see your business really is focusing on more B2B, and especially on the lead generation side. So I think maybe let's talk about the type of B2B business you do and why that became a focus for you.
Okay. So historically, we've always, I'd say, leaned B2B in terms of our client mix. And the only time that changed was probably, around 2000. Or maybe just before. So I had been with the business, you know, full time for 4 or 5 years. And we had 8 or 9 clients. So we had fewer clients, but larger clients. And they were all kind of concentrated in one industry. And what happened was, kind of overnight, client number one bought up clients 2 and 3. And now 80% of our revenue was tied up with one entity, and they decided to go do an agency review. And I spent that summer putting together the presentation of my life, and we went in and presented, and we retained the business. But that really spooked me, Nick, you know, to have suddenly 80% of your revenue tied up with one entity that's about to maybe leave. And I was in the process of executing the buyout with my father. And I'm like, you know, I'm about to lose 80% of the value of what I'm buying.
Yeah.
So that better not happen. And when that happened, I said, I'm going to diversify. I don't care what it is, but it's going to be outside this one industry. I want us to diversify like crazy. And that's what I did. And what I found was that the clients that we seem to have the best relationships with, the most longevity, the best fits, we're more on the B2B side, and what we now affectionately call the brands behind the brands. So, you know, we don't work with, you know, so I have an Aquafina, you know, we don't work with Aquafina, but we'll probably represent the company that makes the cap that goes on Aquafina or the wrap, right? That's our client. Is typically in the supply chain in terms of goods and services of a larger entity or entities. And that's really became that's what became our focus. And then shortly thereafter, I got really, really interested in the subject of brand. Because if you recall, around the same time period, commercial brands were doing their first forays online, right? They were setting up their first websites in like the mid to late 90s. And I was kind of puzzled by the fact that these companies were almost remaking their brands online. So they would look one way offline in their trade show exhibit or their advertising, and then they were kind of totally remaking themselves for their first websites. And I thought, well, that's strange. Why are they, you know, why are they changing? It's one brand still. It's the same brand. Shouldn't there be a common brand experience? Shouldn't there be one brand, one message? And what I started to realize was these companies in that small to mid-sized B2B space don't really have a firm understanding of the power of brand. And that's really where our process, which is now the Brand Leadership Solution, was born. I was actually sitting in a hotel room. It was a rainy day in Toronto waiting for a meeting, and it was raining, so I couldn't go outside. So I was left to wonder. I said, I wonder if we could engineer a process for helping these companies define and build an authentic brand. And what would that look like? And that's where the Brand Leadership Solution was born. And to date, We've run well over 150 different brands through that process. We actually have a patent on the process now. So it's become really the core of what we do here. And all of our solutions are built around that core solution. So,
yeah, I think that middle ground that you're talking about, I think the Unilevers and the Procter & Gambles and folks like that, they can afford companies like Interbrand and folks like that. But the guys who really need help and, like you say, struggle quite a lot are those middle tier guys who don't have a director of brand, don't have a, you know, necessarily a full-time marketing manager. They've got a sales and marketing manager, which is a role that I've always hated, and it's always been sort of pushed towards me because they want to get double value out of you. Okay, you do the balloons and the stands and adverts, but you need to do some real work as well. So, but having said that, I worked at Interbrand, so I did all of those big rebrands, airlines, banks, insurance companies, etc. And I felt sorry for the little guys who I saw had potential, but like you said, were schizophrenic in terms of online, one view, their packaging, other design, you know, looking another way. So it's a fantastic space to be in. So I Interbrand across Africa, working on a couple of cool brands there. And then obviously my own brand agency doing all sorts of weird and wonderful things around emerging markets, which has been very exciting. There's packaging design, there's design, website, content creation, etc. But I think an area that you are quite specialist in as well is that B2B lead generation, or how do you generate B2B leads? Because for consumer marketing, you've got radio, TV, Instagram, Facebook, packaging, etc. But if you're a steel company, or if you're a window company, or if you're selling a service that is, you know, directly to a company, your target market is much smaller. How have you streamlined that process, or how do you work through that process with a new client that you're onboarding?
So it usually starts with, and we have a tool for that. It's a growth planning tool. So we start with a growth strategy, and in that, basically, there's three primary methods to grow a B2B enterprise. You either go out and get more customers, you retain and expand the ones you have, or you find ways to increase buying frequency. And those are the three primary ways that a B2B enterprise will grow. Now, some might say that's a clever statement of the obvious, like, no kidding, right? It gets a little more interesting when we break it down further and say, okay, in each of those methods, there's 10 primary growth channels that can be deployed. And so what you're left with is 30 ways to grow a B2B enterprise. And it would be both irresponsible and inconceivable, especially in the small and middle market, to say, okay, head of sales and marketing, go work on these 30 things and come back when you're done. You know, that's insane. So what we do is say, what are the 3 to 5 that are going to drive growth in the next 12 to 18 months that we can identify, that we believe are achievable, that we can assign a true theory and growth goal to, and build objectives around, so that at the end of that period of time, we can look back and say, either we did or didn't make progress to that end. And we usually look for, in the B2B space, a 10-to-1 ratio or a 10x opportunity value to the cost of implementation. So, you know, if you're going to spend $50,000, there should be at least a $500,000 opportunity value at the back end of it to make sure that there's going to be a good ROI equation. Sometimes we'll have a great idea, but it will say, okay, it's going to cost $100,000 to implement that, and you might make 70 or 80 in terms of your top opportunity value. Well, it's upside down. Maybe a good idea, but it's not worth it, right? Because you'll be upside down after, you know, 18 months with no potential for flipping that, you know, in year two or something like that. So we're looking for, where are the prioritized and most readily available growth opportunities? And the net out is usually it's about quality, not quantity. So a lot of people talk about, oh, I can get you all these leads. Well, we have a client we were working with, and their previous provider was getting them 10 more leads than we are now. but they're delighted with us because, you know, they're seeing little companies like Boeing and Northrop Grumman, and, you know, these major mega brands are not, you know, are now making inquiries. Yeah. So, you know, they're pretty happy. And yeah, the quantity is down, but what they were doing before was spending, you know, they would win 1 out of 10 engagements. And I said, no, there's something wrong here. You're a good company. You provide good value. You provide a custom solution. You know, you should be winning at least 30%. So you're pursuing. So what we now have is a system in place where they vet and validate before they just start firing off quotes. And what it's done is it saved somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 days of one of their, you know, top executives' time. He was spending a good 2 days chasing after ghosts, leads that were not closable. So now he's spending more time with fewer leads, but he's working a process to close. And now they're moving from 10% up to, I think they're at like 22%. So they're heading in the right direction just by really optimizing that process. And again, focusing on quality, not quantity. And that's, you know, it's very easy for that mid-market B2B to get excited by, you know, something that might be kind of a shiny object, but it's really not a good use of time. And there's only so much time we have to put in the field. So we've got to spend the time and the dollars wisely.
Well, it sounds like you are the Deloitte or the McKinsey of the B2B lead world. And that point of quality over quantity, we've had that quite often as well, where folks have said, well, you know, we're not getting enough leads, or give us more leads. And the like you said, time spent chasing after ghosts is cash money down the drain of those senior execs. So I think that quality side is exceptionally important. And the amount of research and thinking that has to go behind those clients is very important as well. So you can't, you know, in terms of lead generation and keeping that pipeline warm as well is also important. And mm-hmm. I think that's where CRM systems come in and management of these leads. I think a lot of folks think if a client says to me, call me next, we're not ready yet, call me in 6 months. Half the time I'll forget about that. But there are tools and systems in that you can use that will, you know, keep you top of mind, or these clients top of mind, which don't break the bank like your sales forces and these very complicated problems, processes. Now, I want to chat about some key challenges specifically for sales execs and marketers in the B2B space. You've spoken about time. You've spoken about the quality of the leads. What other things are clients coming to you with the problems that you can solve for them?
Well, in many cases, and I think you touched on it earlier, Nick, is it's very common, especially in the middle market space or the small middle market B2B space, to see that title of sales and marketing bundled, right? It's a VP of sales and marketing. Well, most of the ones that we deal with, and we do deal with people wearing that title quite often, they didn't get to that position on the basis of their marketing acumen. They got to that position because they knew how to close deals, they have a good sensibility of the marketplace, and they demonstrated some leadership ability. And that's how, and this, they got saddled with this thing called marketing. And it's not to say that they're not good marketers. They typically have very good marketplace insight. In other words, they know that, you know, they know their voice of customer well, they understand their audience well, they understand, you know, what they can put in the field and sell well, but they really don't have marketing skill sets or acumen. So when we come along and say, well, all that stuff that you do in your role that you don't like, we'll do that and we'll make you really get look good, and we'll help you and your sales team go after the most prosperous opportunities and drive your top line, it's a really good proposition and a really good fit. And since we typically do work with a lot of clients that do seem a little bit nutsy, boltsy, or as I say, they're the brands behind the brands, what other agencies might look at is that's not very desirable work. We do it every day and we love it. You know, we have, and we have some longstanding clients to show for it. Our longest standing client is going into year 33.
Wow.
So it actually predates my tenure as a full-time employee. And we've been through 6 CEOs, maybe 10 VPs of sales and marketing, you know, across that span. And it's because we know their industry well. And, you know, for each one, we say, you know, that stuff that you're saddled with, we're going to do that for you. And they're like, here, take it. So it's a good fit.
Now, on a slight tangent, my understanding of the American market is obviously through CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and a variety of other channels. But you're in New Jersey, and is there a big enough market for you in New Jersey, or are you working around the states internationally? It must be a super competitive market in the states. So where do you focus your attention?
Well, we do have a concentration of clients in the New Jersey, New York, and some PA, just because there's a heavy concentration of industry in those three states. And yeah, there's a lot of firms, but a lot of the firms in the region don't exclusively focus on business to business as do we, or pursue the client types that we do. We have worked across the nation, and we have worked globally too. So we have a client in Kenya. We have had clients in Norway and Europe, Canada, you know, you name it. So, you know, thanks to technology and video conferencing. So even pre-COVID, we were quite accustomed to working on Zoom and GoToMeeting and, you know, all the other platforms, because that was a regular nature of communication with some of our overseas clients. So not a big deal.
I'm glad you brought up COVID, because I wanted to ask about how business changed for you during or post-COVID. And I hear there are mutterings about them bringing back masks and a couple of restrictions again towards the end of the year and before the elections. How would your business deal with new restrictions in terms of travel and issues like that? How did your business manage to make it, number one, through COVID, especially with this B2B type business?
Yeah. I'll have to give a lot of credit to my team. So I have a team of 12 people here. And I think by virtue of the fact that we did have some overseas clients already, and that's how we did communicate, we had that familiarity. And also, so in New Jersey, occasionally we have blizzards, sometimes we have hurricanes, and sometimes we have power outages that last more than a few hours, sometimes days or a week. Where we're situated in the town, every now and again, we have a blackout that might take us out for the day. So we already had contingency plans for, you know, emergency situations, and everybody had the means to work remote. So all we did when COVID came around is like, let's take what we would normally do for 1 or 2 days and just protract it like it's every day. And that was our battle plan. And it was fairly seamless. To the credit of our clients, they were pretty quick to get on board with Zoom, with GoToMeeting, with Teams, and adopt those skills pretty quickly. And some we'd actually help them. You know, we'd give them some, here's how to set that up, or if you know, we'd troubleshoot that for them just so that they could communicate. But by virtue of being concentrated in a lot of B2B industries, some that were consumer serving and some where our clients were serving either government or military, they couldn't shut down. So shutting down wasn't an option for them. So we actually grew across the COVID years in terms of both staff and volume of business, as did many of our clients. Some of them were, you know, we helped kind of redirect some of their capabilities to be more COVID serving. So one company realized that they were making trial size hotel amenity shampoos and conditioners in small containers, about the size of a hand sanitizer. And, you know, if you recall, you couldn't get enough hand sanitizers for a while. So they re-engineered their lines to produce hand sanitizers, and ran them in the millions. Another company engineered an interesting face shield for the medical community. Another one was came up with a unique mask configuration. So, and another one provided consulting services to pharma, was now providing same consulting services to distilleries who are now suddenly, instead of making liquor for drinking, they were making sanitizers and cleansers. So there was a lot of, agility required. And we were just thankful that our clients were doing well, that we were doing well, and, happy to work hard and work long hours to support them. So it was a time when none of us will forget, but also a lot to be grateful for across that time as well.
Yeah, well, having a strong team beside you obviously is helps with success. I think the other thing that is to your benefit there is the longevity of your relationships, because you knew they had those particular products and that size packaging. It probably was easier for you to convince them or know that they had these particular elements at their disposal. So I think that's fantastic. The last thing I want to chat about is I've got a new cohort of students starting this summer. And you mentioned that when you were graduating, the last thing you wanted to do was join your dad's business. If you had to go back, well, not go back, if you had to be your age at in 1995 now, and you were a student in marketing or advertising and sales, what would you suggest they do? What are the kind of areas that you look at now and say, man, I wish I was 20 again. This is what I'd go and do in this industry. Let's not talk about going to SpaceX and cryptocurrency and that. What would you say to a younger self now, or if I'm sure you've got maybe a son or daughter, what did you tell them to go into now?
So if they were going to pursue a marketing path or just a, okay. So I would, if I were to go back and talk to my younger self, and I wish I had the time to do this, I would have benefited from working at another firm before joining this one. My situation was a little bit different because I was 22 years old and my father sat down with me and he said, I'd like you to consider coming into the business. I'll teach you what you don't know. We'll do a buyout. We'll do a long-term buyout, but decide over this weekend, because if you don't, I've got 3 or 4 people lined up to buy Dalia Associates. So it was basically me taking a weekend, thinking about it, taking stock of where my friends were, and they were all either going back to school or taking very low-level starter jobs. And I said, I'm 22 years old, and I've got this opportunity for business ownership in front of me. I should probably take that. I should give that a try. So I would say to a young person, when an opportunity presents itself, take it. Go for it. You know, because you're young, and if it doesn't work out, that's okay. But when you see an opportunity, reach for it, go for it. The other thing I would, and I have spoken to students, and we do intern students, when we also do job shadowing, where students will come in for the day and speak to all my department heads and spend the day with the firm. I advise them to really, you know, especially college age, explore, you know, come see a small firm, go look at a big firm. Go look at a medium-sized firm. Go look at a firm that specializes in one category. Look at a lot of different things. And what you like is as valuable as what you don't like, because it all forms what you'll want, you know. And I often tell the students that come here, I said, you may love this day, you may hate it. Both are good, right? Because both formulate what you might do next. And that's really the value of the journey, is really seeing all sides and picking a path that really resonates the most. As I did with brand, you know, that was my passion. That's what resonated the most. And that's where I went. So that's some of the advice that I might give them, or a younger me.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I think that's some great advice, Ed. Ed, thank you so much for taking time to chat with me. And I'm going to share the link of the brand leadership solution, so that anyone who'd like to can go and try that out and see how they can improve their brand's business. And yeah, thanks again. And let's hope you don't have too many blackouts or hurricanes in the near future.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Nick. It was great speaking with you today, and really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you again.
Cool.
Come chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh, and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth.